I am here to talk about our project, and my colleague, Dr. Ellen Barnage, is also here. We're speaking on behalf of the Prevention Research Center in St. Louis, and I'll be talking about how we've worked to understand and address the barriers to implement environmental and policy interventions that support physical activity and healthy eating in rural communities. And we have no relationships to disclose. A little bit of background on specifically rural populations. Children and adults in rural communities are more likely to be overweight and obese. They are less likely to meet recommendations for physical activity and nutrition. And rural communities have limited access to not only be physically active, but to eat healthy. The Prevention Research Center in St. Louis works. My whole plan was to point out where St. Louis is, but I can't get there. So we are on the eastern side, about in the middle of the state, right on the border. And then our communities in which we work are in southeastern Missouri. We work in 12 counties in that area. We meet with them on a monthly basis, sometimes more, in Butler County, and that is at the bottom. It actually borders Arkansas. And Poplar Bluff is the town in Butler County, and that's where we all meet. And that's about 2.5 hours from St. Louis, depending on who's driving. And then from side to side, our community members travel as far as 2.5 hours to meet us. And so it's a big area, and we've been working in that community since 1994. The Prevention Research Center is comprised of academic and community partners, and we work to implement environmental and policy changes that are evidence-based policy changes. This specific project that we'll be talking about is called Healthier Missouri Communities, or Healthier Mo. We work in this community and have done so for the past many years because it, in the state, has the highest rates of obesity, poor nutrition, and low physical activity. A goal of Healthy People 2020 is to eliminate disparities due to geographic location. So with that in mind, we wanted to take a look at what were the disparities between rural and urban communities. And there, we found that there is limited data on what works in rural communities. We also know that multi-level interventions are the most effective at reducing obesity and have the most potential to create sustainable change. We also know that there are, given that most of the data and research is on what works in urban or suburban areas, we know that there are challenges in adopting those interventions to rural communities. There are a lot of situations and experiences in rural areas that are very unique. For example, the evidence-based strategy Safe Routes to School works very well in urban or suburban areas, but in a rural community, it's not feasible for many reasons. You have a county school out off of a rural highway road. There may or may not be sidewalks. If there are, it's not continuous, and people are coming from all over. So that's just not a viable option. So we really wanted to take a look at what was out there and what would be feasible to adapt. The three objectives that we had going into this project was identify the types of environmental and policy interventions in rural communities that promote physical activity and healthy eating, identify barriers to disseminate, implement, and evaluate those interventions, and identify strategies to overcome those barriers. And I'll just back up for a minute. The work that I'm presenting on now was done in 2009, 2010 to set the stage for the project that we're currently working on that Ellen is actually going to present on in a different session later. So this is a lot of the background that helped us get to where we are and helped us structure and frame our work with the community members, because this was new to them as well. And so this was a lot of background work that helped us get to where we are now. So in 2009, 2010, we had a team that had conducted this early literature work, and through that work and through websites and active living rural networks, they identified 15 who we called key informants, and they set out to interview these key informants. In the analysis phase that I'll talk about in a little bit, we used 13 of those 15. In the analysis, we discarded two of the interviews because they did not actually implement any strategies. They talked about technical assistance and providing advocacy. The key informants, as you can see, the stars are where they're located. They represent nonprofit and local government. They self-identified as working in rural communities, and they led environmental and policy efforts. The interviews were over the phone, and the interview protocol was designed using the dissemination implementation theory. And the interview team asked the 15 informants questions about their county and their community demographics in terms of health status, population, location, what types of environmental policy changes they implemented, the barriers to that implementation, and how they overcame those barriers. And then also the key informants were given a $15 gift card to thank them for their time. When the team went to analyze this information, of course, the interviews were recorded, and so we had a team of transcribers to transcribe those interviews. They used a focus coding method to analyze it. For example, one of the questions that they asked about was barriers, and so then they coded based on what those barriers would be. There were teams of two for the coding, an initial and a secondary coder, and that team met regularly to make sure that everybody was on the same page in terms of how they were coding, definitions used, and making sure that if they had five quotations that fit under a certain code, then everybody was in agreement that they fit together. And then, of course, everything that the process was recorded. So every decision was recorded so that we knew what and why things were done. A little bit about our demographics from these 13 interviews. They were primarily Caucasian, but with growing diversity, there were two situations when it was a growing Hispanic community, and that was due to some agricultural opportunities in those rural communities. They were primarily lower income than urban and rural areas. They were more overweight and had higher obesity rates than state averages, and they represented smaller population sizes, which is to be expected when you're talking about rural communities. This shows the physical activity changes that key informants mentioned. So what this says is that walking trails, for example, the first line, that was mentioned 9 times, and it was mentioned 9 unique times, versus bike lanes, those were mentioned 8 times, but only 4 unique times. So there were 37 interventions mentioned, with walking trails being the most common. Healthy eating was mentioned less often, with a total of 21 citations. The most common setting for this was community settings or schools, and community gardens and farmers markets were the most common in terms of both they were mentioned the most and they were mentioned the most times uniquely. This other category at the bottom is talking about summer camp, food at summer camp, and community events. With this information, and this is just a little bit of a insight into Ellen's presentation a little bit later, since community gardens and schools came to the top, community settings and school settings came to the top, that's actually the direction that our community members decided to focus on for the intervention phase that we're in. The key informants talked a lot about barriers to environmental and policy change. Smaller population size, they mentioned, which had to do with affecting funding. They were less likely to get external funding because they felt that funders were less likely to fund them with a smaller impact than as opposed to urban or suburban communities. They also felt that their influence at the state level was limited, and so in order to get policies that affect, it was hard to get policies that affect them because they didn't have that influence up at the state level when they were just a small rural community with little to no voice. They mentioned a lot about their staff being spread too thin. We all know that in local nonprofits and smaller governments, people wear many hats, they do lots of jobs. There's a lot expected of them, and so they were just spread too thin. And there's also a lack of expertise that they mentioned. They might not have the urban design information or the infrastructure capacity to implement this stuff and actually bring in that information to these communities. And then also culture was mentioned. They it was kind of the sense that these were initiatives that didn't make sense to them. It wasn't culturally acceptable. For example, walking is an amenity. It's not a necessity. If they're going to build a road, they're going to make it happen so that a truck or a car can drive down there, not for bikes and or walking. So these are just ideas that weren't feasible or realistic in their communities. And then there was also the sense that rural communities that our key informants worked in, they were slower to change. For example, with respect to healthy eating, they are less likely to try a food because it's just not going to taste good without even giving it a chance. And so whether it's with sidewalks or transportation, urban design, or trying new foods, the key informants mentioned that their communities were less likely and slower to change. And then two more barriers to this type of work. As I said before, there is not a lot of evidence out there that's specific to rural communities. It's all focused on urban and suburban areas, and so it's hard to translate that evidence. Again, we're talking about walkable communities. It's easy to do that in an urban or suburban area, but if you're trying to get people to commute to work in a rural town, there is little to no public transportation, so how exactly will that work given those constraints? And then the local leadership in rural communities, our key informants mentioned that they are slower to realize the connection between social policy and health. So how do communities overcome these barriers? The key informants mentioned a few things. One was to develop a broad-based partnership. Reach out to non-traditional partners, always identify new partners, get referrals, make sure it's a sense of collaboration between everybody. And as you're trying to recruit these new members, especially the non-traditional ones, make sure that people are being educated on what the work is doing, why it's being done, and the possibility of change that could happen. Also build on what currently exists, and know the local ordinances, know the local development plans, and connect that to what you're trying to do and build from it. And also become the expert. There is a lot of passion and wealth of knowledge and commitment in these rural communities, so build on that, and whether it's connecting, to an online training or an expert in a neighboring town or a state official, really become the expert so that you can bring that change to your community. Our recommendations from this is for rural communities to really be able to build and document the evidence. Again, there's just no evidence out there, and so we need to fill that gap. And communities should be encouraged to do needs assessments, to know what the strengths and assets there are in their communities, know who the key partners are that can make a difference and that are willing to think outside the box, and know where the foundation is so that you can build from and connect to other people and other ideas. And then capitalize on those regional resources. One thing that we have begun to do is when we've helped create this community garden network, it doesn't make sense for a training to happen in one town with a few people attending, and so we're trying to build this regional resource network, and so lots of people can tap into those resources and that training and get the knowledge and get the infrastructure and information. And then also just document everything you're doing so that it can contribute to the literature and that it can be translated to neighboring communities, but also other organizations and agencies within your own community can benefit from that knowledge. We recognize that our work does have limitations. If you remember the map earlier with the stars, that's where we did the interviews, and so it's not at all representative of all geographic locations. We also only talked with people that had done this work. We didn't talk with people that were planning to do it. And then we also did not talk about what outcomes happened as a result of their interventions. It was process-oriented and talked about their barriers and the people involved. And so those are limitations in the work. So finally, what's this all for? We always talk and on our team that we really need to understand how to adopt these evidence-based interventions to rural communities in ways that it makes sense and in ways that it will benefit the community. And so not only adopting those interventions, but also build the evidence of effective interventions in these communities so they're not left behind and they have a base of work from which to build from. That's it. Thanks.